Net-a-Porter presents The Incredible Women Podcast, Series 8, The Powerhouses.
Welcome to the new series of The Incredible Women Podcast, in partnership with De Beers, in which we sit down with women who are leading the charge in their industries, those who are admired for their unique talent, strength, drive and influence. All at the top of their game, some of these incredible women you'll already be familiar with, and others we're excited to introduce you to. I'm Alice Casely-Hayford, Content Director at Net-a-Porter, and I couldn't be more excited to be joined for this episode of our Powerhouses series by feminist writer, activist, and organizer Gloria Steinem.
It's very important to me to meet, especially with women who are different from me in culture or country or language or class or experience, because after all, we learn from difference, not from sameness. So difference is a gift.
Born in Ohio in 1934, Gloria Steinem is undoubtedly one of the world's most influential feminists, who has actively campaigned for gender equality and reproductive rights alongside many other causes since the 1960s. In 1968, she helped found New York Magazine, where she was a political columnist and wrote features articles. In 1972, she co-founded Ms. Magazine and remained one of its editors for 15 years. Her books include the bestsellers My Life on the Road and Moving Beyond Words. As Gloria Steinem celebrates her 90th birthday, it is a huge honor to celebrate her and the invaluable contribution she has made, one that we are all indebted to her for. Let's meet her. Well, hello, Gloria. Welcome. It is such a pleasure to be speaking with you today. How are you doing?
Fine. We're freezing here in New York. I don't know about you, but...
We're freezing here too in London, yeah. So it's...
All right. Okay. All right. Well, we can share that.
We can share that, but hopefully spring is coming soon. This podcast is called The Powerhouses, and much of your life's work has been about inequalities and power. But what does power mean to you today?
Power hopefully means the ability to govern our own lives and does not mean power over other people, which is, I think, where the problem begins.
Absolutely. Well, before we really get stuck in, you're about to celebrate a very huge milestone. You're going to be turning 90 shortly, so a very, very happy almost birthday to you. But how do you feel about entering your 90s?
It feels completely surrealistic. You'll see when you get there. Because you feel like exactly the same person you were when you kind of gelled at maybe 30 or 40 or something. And it feels like 90 is someone else's age. But I'm trying to use it to remind me to use my time well, since obviously there's not, even though I plan to live to 130, which I understand is the age of the oldest woman in the world, still there's not that much time left.
Mm. So speaking of that precious time, are there any specific lessons that you're taking with you from your 80s? And is there anything that you'd like to, or you're happy to leave behind?
Well, I'm happy to leave the pandemic behind. The only good impact of it seems to me that we understood better that we are all on spaceship Earth, that national boundaries were not respected by the pandemic and actually are artificial. So that was a good lesson, I think. But for myself, I realize how little I've done of what I'm supposed to be, which is a writer. And so we'll see what happens, but I hope to do more.
Well, that's very funny to hear you say how little of it you've done. Most of us would agree that you've done a great deal in terms of your writing and the incredible, invaluable contribution that you've made. In terms of living to 130 and still having much more writing to do, what sort of thing is it that you feel most compelled to write about? What still do you have to say?
I think what we're talking about now, the commonalities across boundaries that are personal, the inequities across boundaries, which still means that the melanin in our skin, or whether we are male or female, or whether we can afford an education or not, all those things matter way too much. And we have to work to keep them from being boundaries.
And speaking of words, you, of course, have a formidable way with words. When did you first realize the power of words and language in terms of driving change?
Oh, that's interesting. I guess because I read constantly as a child. My family was often traveling, so I wasn't going to school that much. I was in love with a American author, Louisa May Alcott, who wrote Little Women. Perhaps that's an author who's traveled abroad.
Yes,
too.
Loved by all of us.
Yeah. So it just seemed to me real. I mean, even when I was too little to write, I would scribble and say to my mother, look, I'm writing. It just was always present in my life.
Fantastic. And you've spoken a lot because you had an incredible influence from your mother and your father, but in very different ways. And your mother challenged the status quo in terms of her work in some ways. Can you tell us a little bit more about the influence of your parents?
My mother, long before I was born, before my older sister was born, had been a newspaper reporter, which she absolutely loved. And ended up, for various reasons of geography and child rearing, giving up. And I always felt that. I mean, she used to teach me how to fold a piece of paper in thirds to make a reporter's notebook in your palm before there were reporter's notebooks. There were always tons of books in the house, so I read very indiscriminately, just, you know, across the shelf instead of selecting. And I was in love with Louisa May Alcott, who, of course, was a writer of great influence. Mm.
And can you tell us a little bit more about your father? He very much influenced you by the sounds of things in terms of his approach to travel. He was constantly on the road, and that was something that has been a huge, huge part of your life. Can you tell us a little bit more about your relationship and his influence?
Well, my father had two points of pride. He never wore a hat, which is in his generation one was supposed to do. And he never had a job, by which he meant he never worked for anyone else. He started a kind of summer dance pavilion in southern Michigan, which is what I remember most first. And then, because, of course, you can't make a living, you know, in the winter, he would put us all, my sister, me, the dog, my mother, everybody, into a house trailer. And we would go to Florida or California, buying and selling antiques along the way, going to a trailer park, which was, it was a great way to live. It's true that I used to look at the houses along the way with porches and gardens and want to live there. You know, you always kind of envy what you're not experiencing. But in retrospect, it was good because I escaped a lot of the restrictions and ideas of class or race that might have been in the classroom. And I got to read anything I wanted, which was perfect, and fall in love with the ocean.
Wonderful. Well, one of the most moving parts I found in My Life on the Road, your brilliant, brilliant book, is two letters that you received from friends of your father that sort of made you understand him in a new way and really appreciate his kindness, albeit his parenting wasn't as orthodox as some of maybe your peers. It really made you see him in a new light. And I lost my father when I was 29, and I think you were 27, so we're a similar age. And there was so much more that I wanted to share with him. So it was truly, truly devastating to me. But actually, having the privilege of getting to hear stories about him from his peers that have just happened after his death have been incredibly meaningful to me. So can you tell me a little bit more about that experience for you?
Yes, it was, I think, very abrupt and tragic to have this relationship cut off. I also arrived too late he had been in a hospital bed and I just arrived too late. And I remember being given his wallet, which was still kind of worn and curved from being in his back pocket. And, you know, I just so remember the sadness and the unfinishedness of it. But I also remember that he always treated me like a buddy or a playmate rather than a child. And for instance, he loved to eat. So he loved malteds and milkshakes. So when I was very young, like 5 or something, he would give me money and send me into the place that sold milkshakes and told me to order a milkshake and then pretend. And he would come in later and order one, but I had to pretend I didn't know him, even though I was only 5 or 6. So that we would each get the dividend in the bottom of the bottle.
Genius.
Right. So I remember that about him. I remember that he always felt that the cure for almost anything was a movie and a malted. It's kind of not wrong.
I love that that's a mantra to live by, for sure. But losing your parents as a young adult and also living a life on the road, sort of how have you found anchoring or security and stability? Or is that not something that you need in a traditional sense?
Well, I didn't really quite know it existed. I mean, I envied people who, especially when I was in college, I encountered people who, of course, were living more usual lives and had a house in a neighborhood and relatives and all of that. So I did kind of miss that. I thought it would arrive in my life with marriage. But then at the same time, marriage in my era felt like the end, not the beginning. It was like your last choice you could ever make. So I was resisting it. And going off to live in India for 2 years. And that, was a huge, huge education because it was very close still to the independence movement. It's a huge and diverse country. I was sort of on my own, though people there were so kind to me that, the other students that I have to credit them. But it did really teach me that most of the world does not live the way you and I do in our two countries.
Mm. Well, that's such an important lesson. And I think, you really encourage people to travel, whether it's just to the end of their road or within their country or ideally abroad, because it teaches you so much more beyond our immediate existence. And I think that is such an important lesson. But in terms of you just mentioning traveling alone quite a lot, what is it that brings you a sense of community and togetherness?
Well, I feel about my women friends that they are my family. Since my family wasn't always able, because of illness on my mother's part or traveling on my father's part, to be a supportive family, women are my family. My women friends are my family. Whether they're in India or here, they're still my family.
And speaking of that family, obviously you are one of the most influential, most incredible inspirations in terms of the women's movement. But what have you learned from some of your peers who you grew up with and the generation of activists that came through with you?
Well, my peers, remember that I was really coming of age in the 1950s, which was a very, very conservative time for many reasons, including the fact that our societies were trying to get us back to what they thought was normal after World War II. And this meant getting women out of the labor force and back at home and having children and, not taking jobs from men and all of that. So it was very difficult because I didn't see how I could live a life that was different from that. And yet I knew I wasn't ready to do that, especially in the image of the feminine mystique, so-called, and giving up your own life. I have still to this day talking circles in my living room of 12 or 20 women who come and sit and say what we're doing and how we can help each other or learn from each other. So we are a family.
Mm. Gosh, well, I'd love to be a fly on the wall for one of those. That sounds magical.
Well, come to New York.
Well, now you've invited me. I'm going to have to take you off on that offer. But okay. I'd love to hear then, looking back at your immense career as you turn 90, is it possible for you to pick a moment that brings you the greatest pride or that was truly pivotal for you in terms of your career and your body of work?
Well, that's difficult because I always feel I haven't done it yet. You know, I mean, I still live in the future. Looking back, my first published writing, you know, certainly was important to me. And also, together with a dozen other writers, we started New York Magazine, which was, at least in this country, the first of the city magazines. And, you know, great fun and full of adventure. And I had a weekly column and, you know, it gave us all a sense of connection to the city and the country because we felt if something was amiss, we should write about it. It was communal and unique because it was within our control. We weren't just sitting about waiting for assignments.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've spoken a lot, particularly at the beginning of your career and as a freelance writer, about the misogyny you experience and the dreadful things certain male editors might say to you. That's certainly something I experienced at the start of my career. And unfortunately, even quite recently, what would your advice be? And how did you persevere as a journalist and think, goodness, I've got to keep going. I can't be deterred by these wretched men.
Well, in my case, eventually, we did start New York Magazine. So that, you know, made a huge difference. But I still remember being sent by my agent to an editor at Life magazine, I think. And as I approached his desk, he looked up at me and said, "We don't want a pretty girl, we want a writer. Go home."
Good Lord.
Right. And that was it. Right. And also, I used to write for our New York Times Sunday magazine here, but the assignments that they would give me were, I wrote one whole article about textured stockings. If you go, right?
Oh gosh!
And I could get them to let me write a profile, but it would be of the wife of the mayor, yeah. Not the mayor.
Yeah.
Right.
But what compelled you to keep pushing forward? And were there points where you thought, gosh, I'm just going to throw in the towel. I've had enough here.
Well, I didn't know what I could do if I threw in the towel. I mean, so since I'd never had a proper job and didn't really want one, I guess my version of throwing up the towel was getting together with other writers and starting New York Magazine.
Well, thank heavens you did. We are so grateful for that and your incredible contribution to journalism and, of course, the feminist movement. But in terms of being referred to as this kind of figurehead and feminist hero, how do you deal with that title and the pressures that come with it? Or is it something that you can just block out? Because as you say, you feel you still have so much to do.
I mean, I just don't believe it. I mean, I know better. And so it's very important to me to meet, especially with women who are different from me in culture or country or language or class or experience, because after all, we learn from difference, not from sameness. So difference is a gift. And, you know, having a free living room so that I can invite people to talking circles or can go to events is, I think it's as it should be. I haven't since college ever been in a situation in which we were learning from one person. We were always learning from each other.
Yeah, well, that's such a beautiful thing to hear. You know, you speak a lot about the future and what more you'd like to do. Can you tell us a little bit more about your foundation?
The foundation really is being born in order to own and look after my house. I live in a brownstone here in New York, and a brownstone, like many in London too. And in fact, I saw in London a brownstone that had a little bronze plaque outside, and I think it was left from the suffragist era and used as a meeting house. So it gave me the idea of leaving my house so that it would be a place for individual women to stay when they were in town, or small groups of women to have meetings. Of course, I mean, I now own three floors. There are perfectly healthy two women on floors four and five. So they have something to say about this. But I would like to leave a talking circle house.
That sounds phenomenal. Before we talk more about what you might leave in your legacy, can we talk about your down days, if you ever have any? How do you switch off, and what brings you peace, and when do you feel sort of the most relaxed?
Well, after, you know, at the end of a day, I'm more than happy to watch stories on television, go to the movies. So those forms of community and relaxing are very important. Mm. And also just doing nothing, you know.
But I think I'd really love to hear more about the contemporaries that you've learned from, and if there's a single piece of advice from anyone, whether it's your contemporaries, your peers, or your parents, friends, a single piece of advice that's really, really stayed with you.
Well, I think, I mean, Robin Morgan is a friend and a writer of more or less the same generation. And she's very fierce in her intellect, and therefore I always learn from her. Wilma Mankiller, I learned a great deal from. She was the chief of the Cherokee Nation here. And of course, long before Europeans showed up on this subcontinent, there were very sophisticated, self-governing nations here. Sometimes history treats this country as if it started when Columbus arrived, but that's not true at all. And Wilma came from a matrilineal culture, not matriarchal, but matrilineal, with great balance between humans and nature. No, there's no shortage of great women to learn from.
And we spoke about you living to 130. What would you like the world to be looking like then? And even looking beyond that, where do you hope the world is in 90 years from now? And what do you think it will really take to get there?
Well, I hope that we will have seen by then that warfare anywhere in the world is bad for people everywhere in the world. I hope also we will have come to treasure difference instead of mistrusting difference, and to finally get rid of the colonial idea that the amount of melanin in our skin has anything to do with who we are, as opposed to each of us being unique. I mean, it's such, if there's any single tragedy, it seems to me colonialism, which produced racism and other craziness, and patriarchy. We have to count patriarchy, since if only women have wombs, then in order to advance and preserve racism, you have to have patriarchy.
Oh, quite. In terms of recent American history, and speaking specifically about racism, there have been two pretty major movements in terms of the resurgence of Black Lives Matter and Stop Asian Hate. Observing those and being a part of those conversations, do you feel that we're moving in the right direction, and that progress is being made, and that we might get closer to this place that you were just talking about in the next 90 years?
Yes, I do believe progress is being made, but we seem to go forward in waves and then a backlash, and waves and then a backlash. So I'm sorry to say that the election of Trump here, for which I apologize to, and I'm afraid that our media didn't report enough that the degree to which his presidency and the people who support him were looking backward, not forward, and that included racism and patriarchy. I mean, his attitudes toward women were terrible and famous, right? So that was a lesson, you know, that a man like that could get into our White House was sobering.
To say the least. But I think even, obviously, we had our own versions of the movement here in the UK. But I think, to your point, progress has been made, but it feels very much two steps forward and one step back. A lot of the responses globally, but certainly in the media here, were quite performative and about optics. And as a Black woman myself, I feel that what initially bubbled away and there was a lot of outrage and action has subsided in the past 18 months. So that's really frustrating, but I'm not sure what it will take for it to kick back up again, but I'm hopeful.
I agree, it does go forward in waves. In the simplest way, I suppose it's just trying to make sure that we ourselves in our groups look something like the world.
I completely agree. And I constantly think about the statement that you reiterate, linked, not ranked. And I hope that that is a place that we will get to, if not immediately. We're getting closer to that, or at least maybe it's my echo chamber, but I feel that it's a sentiment that's more broadly shared.
No, well, thank you for that, because it's the shortest way I've ever managed.
Well, if people just can't remember anything, they've got to remember that statement, because that is right. Very, very powerful. So one thing that I really wanted to speak to you about, and you discussed this in a podcast with Elizabeth Day, but is that you haven't for a millisecond regretted not having children. And I love that candor in which you say that. Can you realistically envisage a world in the near future where the expectation of motherhood on women isn't such a burden and, I guess, yeah, an expectation?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, for a long time, I assumed I had to have children because everybody had children. But I do think it has changed. And I think we nurture each other, including young people, in a wide variety of ways, whether we have given birth to those people or not. But since I am long past childbearing age, I don't feel, I think, you know, whoever disapproved must have given up by now. But I think that one helpful change would be to increase the role of fathers, to understand that just as whether or not women give birth, we can be nurturing, men also can be nurturing. We've too often sent men to the office and away from their children and haven't allowed them to be the nurturing souls they can be.
I wholly agree. And I'm about to become a mother for the second time and I'm pretty frightened going into that.
Oh, that's very exciting.
Oh,
how old
you.
is your first child?
My first, my son is 2.5 and we've got another son incoming. So I kind of had this expectation that I'd have daughters. So it's quite a new thing to be raising men, but I'm very excited to do so and hopefully have lots of lessons from you that I can inspire these guys with.
That's very exciting. That's great.
Thank you. And in terms of being misunderstood or misinterpreted, misrepresented, how do you shut out that noise and that ignorance and keep that drive and focus?
Well, it was more difficult in the past when I was more in public life, and funny things would happen. I mean, for instance, I was always speaking together with a friend, a woman of color, so Flo Kennedy or Margaret Sloan, and they actually, probably for reasons of racial assumptions, were often way better at handling it than I was. I mean, some hostile white guy in the audience would rise up and ask us if we were married or not. and Flo or Margaret would say, "Are you my alternative?" which would make the audience laugh. And so, right. And didn't satisfy him in any way with an answer or dignify him with an answer. It's just a challenge to, I think, to first of all be whoever we are individually, to communicate that in a way that can be absorbed, you know, by another human being that isn't hostile or categorizing, And humor is very important, don't you think? I mean,
I think it's wholly important. And it sounds like you have a fantastic sense of humor as well.
No, it turns out that laughter is the only emotion that can't be compelled. I mean, you can obviously make people feel afraid of you. If you're dependent for long enough, you may feel you're in love when you're really not, just in order to survive. But our Native American cultures have a god of laughter, for instance, who is a kind of symbol of freedom because you can't compel laughter. So if, as a general rule, we don't go any place where they won't let us laugh or where people are not occasionally laughing, we'll be in a free place.
Well, I think that is a wonderful and joyful note to end on. But before we finish off, I just have one final question. Who are the incredible women? And it obviously sounds like you have an amazing community of chosen family and brilliant women surrounding you. But are there any individuals who are really inspiring you for 2024 and beyond?
Well, I have a friend and colleague who's a lot younger than I am, Amy Richards, who walked into my life long ago to help me with research for a book. And now she's writes her own books, has her own children, but is just a gift in my life because she's someone I totally trust and I know will be here long after I'm gone.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time today. It's been the absolute greatest pleasure chatting with you and learning so much from you. We are so grateful for all you do. And thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you.
The Powerhouses was brought to you by Net-a-Porter and Chalk and Blade, hosted by Net-a-Porter's content director, Alice Casely-Hayford, and fashion director, Kay Barron. The team at Net-a-Porter was Katie Berrington as the senior editor, with casting by Annabelle Brog and Olivia Wakefield, and coordination by Gabriella Pereira. The producer at Chalk and Blade was Laura Hyde, with help from Emily Wally. Original music by Alexis Adamora, and the series was mixed by Nasson da Silva. To make sure you hear all the episodes in this series, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information, go to net-a-porter.com.